From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In Shakespeare's Hamlet, the young Danish prince remarks of tragedy and comedy that Seneca cannot be too heavy, nor Plautus too light. This comment might be construed as an acknowledgement of Shakespeare's debt to classical sources, some of which reach him by way of Italian Renaissance literature. Soundings now presents a conversation about the origins, development, and influences of Italian Renaissance comedy. My guest is Louise George Club, a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center who teaches comparative literature at the University of California at Berkeley. Professor Club is the general editor of the Biblioteca Italiana, a bilingual series of Italian classics published by the University of California Press.
If you take comedy as specifically a theatrical representation of arguments which arouse laughter at what is ridiculous and end in merriment, as opposed, say, to narrative comedy, to novellas, or any kind of storytelling that has a comic element, certainly Italian Renaissance comedy is significant, outstanding in Europe in that it is the earliest. It's often been said, in fact, that the birth of modern comedy, this is a title often used for books on Italian comedy, takes place in Italy. Mm-hmm. When one thinks of the names associated with Italian vernacular Renaissance comedy, and I use all these words to describe it advisedly, one realizes that the first significant name is that of Ariosto, about 1508, and that's almost 60 years, over 50 years before the birth of Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. So we are talking here then about something that happened much earlier in Italy than elsewhere. But this question is a very important one, because in the Middle Ages, for example, the word comedy did not have the general significance that it would take on in the Renaissance. Dante's long narrative poem about heaven, hell, and purgatory was called the comedy. Mm-hmm. Later on, it was called the divine comedy as a term of praise. But why was it called comedy? It's not a play, and it's not all that funny either. It's called comedy because it ends happily. Uh-huh. And also because the style that is used in it was the middle style thought to be suitable for a genre of this kind. But Italian Renaissance comedy has a completely different goal. What really causes Italian Renaissance comedy is the general cultural effect of humanism, or the recovery of Latin and Greek learning in a secular sense, and above all, the imitation of the models of the literary genre which had been developed by the ancients. Now, for comedy, what this meant then to the 15th century, when humanism was really getting underway in Italy, again, much earlier than elsewhere in Europe, this really meant Aristophanes, Menander, Plautus, and Terence. Now, Aristophanes was available only to the still relatively few who knew Greek. Menander had not been recovered at all. Plautus and Terence, therefore, became the basic models of comedy. So it's in the 15th century that Italian humanists begin imitating Plautus and Terence slowly, because they're using medieval dramatic farce and various forms of this kind to bring on stage situations which are analogous to those that they would have found in Plautus and Terence's Latin comedies.
Now, why did they do this? What were some of the social ends that they were after?
It's
what motivated them to write?
It's the cultural avant-garde that is doing this. It's part of the whole humanistic program to undertake new methods of education, put new emphases on the kinds of skills and learning that were appropriate, de-emphasizing some of the medieval scholastic goals. But of course, the main thrust of the Renaissance proper was to do this kind of thing, to rival the ancients, but in the vernacular languages. So we don't have anything we can really call Italian Renaissance comedy until we have writers beginning to produce these native imitations of the ancient genre in the modern languages.
And what did they do with them? What were they up to, these imitators? Who were they writing for, and what were they writing about?
Well, if I tell you the names of the first officially recognized writers of Italian comedy, you know, in the sense of high commedia, you'll see for whom they were writing. Ariosto is always given primacy here. Mm-hmm. Cardinal Bibbiena is the next most important. Machiavelli is another important name. You see immediately that these are all courtiers, church dignitaries, writers who are attached either to the Este court, as Ariosto was, or to the Medicis, to the papal court, as Cardinal Bibbiena was. And it's, again, as I say, a cultural avant-garde, despite the fact that there's a high degree of bawdry and jocosity at all levels. These plays originally are intended for a very cultivated audience, and indeed by their continued reference to the ancients and to the models they're imitating, to Plautus, to Terence. Cardinal Bibbiena, for example, has his characters and his prologue boast that he has not robbed Plautus, not at all. Go and search Plautus, you'll find that all his parts are there. This kind of deliberate pointing to one's own imitation and one's own being in that tradition, but having produced something that is in the vernacular language, is all a kind of cultural swaggering, as it were, that is characteristic of a group of literary, dramatic, theatrical dilettante in the sense of those who are undertaking these things not because they are professional playwrights, but in order to delight their friends or their patrons, in order to show their own learning, in order to show that they knew Plautus, in order to show that they are forging in the vernacular language something of infinite cultural worth.
Give me an example.
Well, let's just stick with Cardinal Bibbiena. His comedy, La Calandria, is the origin, the source, of all of those enchanting heroines in boys' clothes who tread the stage throughout the 16th century, who come to mind, first of all, when one thinks of Shakespearean comedy.
People like Portia.
People like Portia, but even more people like Viola, or Rosalind, or Imogene and Cymbeline during the brief disguise period. In short, the transvestite heroines of Shakespeare, which then proceed to go down through the ages until finally we end up with Dustin Hoffman.
In Tootsie.
And the latest twist on it, yes. It's really Cardinal Bibbiena's Calandria that first uses this figure on stage in comedy. There are plenty of medieval narratives in which girls dress up as boys. Cardinal Bibbiena simply uses it in a functional way. He takes what is already an old device in ancient comedy, the device of twins. These are Greek twins in Rome. They have lost each other and their parents.
So this is not a contemporary setting for the courtiers. This is
It's a contemporary. It's early 16th century Rome.
I see.
And these are early 16th century Greeks, who have fled from Western Greece. Actually, they've fled. They've come across the Adriatic with one of their servants, but they have become separated from each other. And they have both come to Rome, unbeknownst to each other, and have found refuge with Roman families. The boy twin has gotten himself involved with a beautiful young married woman and her foolish old husband, the typical cuckold figure. his sister has dressed herself as a boy in order to protect her virtue in this strange city, and she too has found refuge in a respectable Roman family and been given a position as a kind of page and a foster child, as it were. And the young girl in that family, the daughter of that family, has gone and fallen in love with this handsome page, whom she, of course, doesn't recognize as being another woman. Well, it's a foregone conclusion. You can see what's going to happen. It's Twelfth Night. It's the plot of Twelfth Night, but in a Roman setting and with a different flavor, quite a different tone. And, of course, there's an active adultery being carried on between the boy twin and the beautiful young unsatisfied wife of the old cuckold, Calandro, for whom the play is named.
And this was written by a cardinal of the Catholic Church.
This is written by a cardinal of the Catholic Church. It's a cardinal, of course, who is sometimes said to have died from poison administered either by his employer, the Pope, or by one of his rivals. This is undoubtedly a canard. Nevertheless, it was a papal court. This is the papal court of Leo X, Medici Pope. He is the one who was supposed to have said when he was elected to the papacy, godiamoci il papato poiché Dio ce l'ha dato, or let's enjoy the papacy because God gave it to us. This is the kind of thing, of course, that the Counter-Reformation set itself to work to reform. It's this kind of pre-Counter-Reformation papacy, the kind of papacy that Martin Luther was understandably excited about. But when it was presented in Rome in 1513 in a very elaborate and brilliant production with sets by Raphael, sponsored by Pope Leo X, an enormous crowd came. Hundreds and hundreds thronged to this papal entertainment.
And what was the reaction?
And, well, they were enchanted by it. Of course, it really is a very funny comedy, if played properly. And it has jokes of all kinds, a great deal of bawdry. The adultery is only part of it, because, of course, all of this falling in love with disguised women and is also matched by suggestions of homosexuality in men falling in love with pretty young boys as well. And there is almost no level of physical humor that is not touched on verbally, or although we know very little about the actual acting of the play at this point. Presumably, there were openings for the bawdiest kind of physical action as well. But to see a highly structured action, a closely plotted comic situation, based on ancient plays, based on the well-thought-out comedies of Plautus, in which everything happens in one day, where there is unity of time and place and action, although these rules were not formulated yet by Italian critics. But to see ordinary middle-class people disporting themselves on a city street which was designed to look like a contemporary Italian town, and to see these people engaging in festive holiday behavior, jumping in and out of windows, pinching each other, cuckolding each other, kissing behind doors, was a representation of reality. It was the reality of the thing that amused them to begin with. The idea of a purely secular entertainment here, mm-hmm. of a drama that was not in any sense a reenactment of some saint's legend or of any kind of Christian rite.
Did anybody in the church get mad at this stuff and say, no, you can't do it? Was there an institutional reaction?
Institutional? No, not until later in the century. When the Counter-Reformation, in fact, set out either to get rid of the drama, as some churchmen would have liked, or to reform it or use it for church ends, as others more successfully maintain should be the aim. But at this time, around 1513, although fairly large audiences might be gathered together to see a play like Bibbiena's Calandria, the church did not yet see this as a threat to the morality of the masses. And on the contrary, regarded such plays as part of the church sponsorship of humanistic education, in a sense. These plays, too, remember, were not put on commercially. There was no commercial theater. And even at the height of the Italian Renaissance comedy, until the professional comics of the Commedia dell'arte got started later in the century, there was no commercial theater. There were no theaters built until quite late in the 16th century, and even those stable theaters were not open for pay to a regular public. They didn't have a theatrical season. Mm-hmm. They were not like the theaters in London or in Madrid in the late 16th century.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a conversation about the origins, development, and influences of Italian Renaissance comedy. My guest is Louise George Club, a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, who teaches comparative literature at the University of California at Berkeley. Professor Club is the general editor of the Biblioteca Italiana, a bilingual series of Italian classics published by the University of California Press.
You mentioned Shakespeare a few moments ago. How does all of this feed into or contribute to English comedy in the Renaissance, and I suppose later on, the 16th, 17th centuries?
The question of Shakespeare's indebtedness to Italy is a very controversial one, even though it's been studied for many, many years. Clearly, his plays are very Italianate. Some would say because he uses Italian names. He uses Italian novellas, either translated into French or through some other method known to him. Italy was, above all, the sin capital of the world. And like all sin capitals, it was completely fascinating to the English imagination, and the English travelers always came back with the latest fashions, and one finds them on the stage in England with Lilly, of course, but even earlier than Lilly, at the universities. Italian fashions in drama were taken up very soon, but by Shakespeare's time, a member of his own company, Will Kemp, made trips to Italy and, of course, established contact with the Italian. At this point, the actors in the Commedia dell'arte were active in Italy, so that Will Kemp could bring back to England with him actual technical details of how the plays were presented at home. Moreover, Italian actors also traveled to England. And when Queen Elizabeth wanted an Italian entertainment, she simply spoke to one of her court musicians, Antonio Ferrabosco, and asked him to arrange something in the Italian fashion. And as most Italian musicians who served at courts were also in contact with actors, we may be sure that what Ferrabosco presented to her would have been the most fashionable development in the Italian theater. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare's court company, of course, played at court, and so that was one of the ways in which contact would have been established. But of course, also just the reports brought by travelers, by the young noblemen who were able to make the trip, make a stay in Italy, the kind of picture of Italy that Sir Philip Sidney gives when he speaks of the superior ideas of dramaturgy that the Italians have, comparing unfavorably the mixed up and formless things that English playwrights are putting on. All of these things would be ways in which Shakespeare and his contemporaries would have known about Italian drama, even if they had no direct knowledge.
What did Shakespeare do to this stuff? Did he do anything peculiar as he adapted it and transformed it? What, for instance, would the Italians themselves have said about about what Shakespeare had done to it.
Well, of course, Shakespeare is such a great transformer of everything he touches, whether it's Italian comedy or Plutarch. No one could possibly recognize the raw material except as being precisely that, and looking at what Shakespeare does with it. But anyone who knows Italian drama or has read a good deal of Italian comedy is always struck by the fact that Shakespeare's plays, especially some of his early comedies, are intensely Italian. And some of them, when translated back into Italian, as they constantly are, I mean, contemporary Italians are devoted Shakespeareans, some of them seem to be Italian comedies.
They improve on the originals?
Well, some of them are better Italian comedy than Italian commediografi themselves wrote, yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, this is one of the reasons, I think, why Italian comedy is not as well known to modern audiences as it perhaps ought to be, that Italy never produced a Shakespeare, not that any place else did either, but although some of the most famous names in Italian literature are those who wrote the comedies, beginning with Ariosto and going right on through the century, Machiavelli, Grazzini, Della Porta, Giordano Bruno, the fact is that Italian comedy, though it was the first in Europe of what we call the modern style of comedy, didn't have a Shakespeare, didn't have a Molière, didn't have a Lope de Vega, didn't have a Tirso de Molina, even. And therefore, it has been relatively neglected on the general reading lists, and as a result, the deeply Italianate quality of much of the drama of Western Europe has not been fully recognized. Shakespeare wasn't limited, wasn't trammeled by certain ideas of structure, of unity. He could write freely, and of course he could draw, as I think primarily he did, on the highly developed English native medieval tradition of drama. But he could use what came to hand from his own knowledge of the Italian comedians, from what he heard from friends, from what he may have been able to read in Italian. And Italian plays were printed in England occasionally, even in English, mm-hmm. And also in Italian.
Let me ask you about how some of these important elements in Italian Renaissance comedy come to us. In the 1980s, what elements survive?
You mean aside from Dustin Hoffman?
Sure. what elements survive, and how do we see them in drama, film today? What are the inspirations that you look at and you say, aha, I see a connection there? You're talking about some of the things that we see on American sitcoms on television.
Yes, yeah.
Very old devices, yeah. I take it.
Yes, if one looks from the 20th century back to the Renaissance, these figures have always been present. Before that, no, not in theater, because before that you don't have theater in the same sense. The basic situation is youth versus age, love versus interests of some kind. Interests might be simply money or family interests, or might be opposing intentions of the older generation involving marriages of another kind for different reasons. The basic characters are always middle-class characters, well-to-do businessmen, generally opposing their own sons and daughters, aided and or hindered by their employees, their servants, or else the people of the contemporary society whose livelihoods depended on them. Prostitutes, for example, figure very very frequently in these comedies. And then a group of other stock characters get involved. Pedants hired to teach humanistic learning to young men. Braggart captains, frequently Spanish, especially when they're in parts of Italy where there was Spanish occupation in the 16th century. It was a way of satirizing the conqueror. Mm-hmm. Nurses, generally bawdy, like Juliet's nurse in Romeo and Juliet, standard example. Cheeky page boys, there's one of those also in Romeo and Juliet. And into these situations, then, one can introduce action lines moving in several directions. You can have double and triple plots, two or three sets of lovers, all loving in the wrong direction, perhaps, and all opposed by their parents for sometimes prudent reasons, sometimes for very poor reasons, or sometimes just on general principles. And then around these, the other characters can be grouped, the servants multiplied to fit the number of young and old people. And then, of course, there are also mothers, and sometimes the mothers are opposing the fathers and so forth. This is pretty much the range of characters, and as you see, it is rather strictly limited. The essential situations are not new.
And the people and the situations.
The people and the situations. Of course, their externals can change. Uh-huh. And when these, even in their own time, that is, even in the 16th century, when these middle-class characters get used by Shakespeare, for example, they are, more often than not, they cease to be middle-class. They undergo promotions in rank. And the same would apply in a Norman Lear situation. Because, of course, the plot I've been describing is also very similar to the plot of The Marriage of Figaro. And French 18th century drama, on which Mozart was drawing directly for his kind of plots, develops out of the Renaissance tradition, which France got from Italy.
Do you think most people are aware of these debts and these connections that exist? My guess would be probably not.
No, I think most people are not, but then again, you have to take it in levels. Most people looking at Tootsie would not be aware that this refers back to Shakespeare, even though the name of Shakespeare is mentioned at least once in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Even fewer people looking at Shakespeare would realize that there is a connection yet to be fully explained and accepted between Shakespeare and what went before him in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, how many Italians who go to see revivals, and of course an Italian Renaissance comedy is always revival for a modern Italian audience, are aware that the Italian plays were conscious imitations of Plautus and Terence. So that, of course, the answer to this in every case is yes, some people are, but the number of people who are grows smaller and smaller as we move from Tootsie back to Plautus.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. My guest was Louise George Klub, a professor of comparative literature at the University of California at Berkeley, where she serves as general editor of the Bibliotheca Italiana, a bilingual series of Italian classics published by the University of California Press. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a conversation about Italian Renaissance comedy. My guest is a professor of comparative literature from the University of California at Berkeley. In Shakespeare's Hamlet, the young Danish prince remarks of tragedy and comedy that Seneca cannot be too heavy, nor Plautus too light. An indirect acknowledgement of Shakespeare's debt to classical sources, many of which reached him by way of Italian Renaissance literature. What's the nature of this literary debt? How is it transformed by Italian and English Renaissance writers? And how does it reach academic and popular audiences today? Listen for some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.